Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Now, let's talk to one of the two winners in this week's gubernatorial election. That's right. In case you missed it, there were two. Of course, Charlie Baker won the race for the corner office by capturing more than 48% of the vote. Evan Falchuk got a little more than 3% of the vote, but that was a victory for him because it was just enough to establish his United Independent Party as an official party in the state, which means it will be able to hold a primary in 2016. And Evan Falchuk joins us now to talk about the election and the future of his nascent political party. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
And first of all, how pleased are you with that result on Tuesday?
Very pleased.
Good. Tell me why. Because, you know, people just need to understand why 3% is a victory.
Well, under the Massachusetts state law, if you create a, if you're a political designation, you become an official party if you get 3% of the vote in a statewide election.
Yeah.
And we worked tirelessly to make that into a reality. We started with 56 of us that decided to create this political designation. We set about building the organization, doing all the hard work, getting involved in everything we could get ourselves involved in, and just building so many relationships all across the state that translated into the result of over 71,000 people coming out to vote for a new party, independent party.
And tell us why that's important. We talked to you a couple of months ago about the United Independent Party. Remind us of what you want this party to stand for.
The trouble we've got today is that the political process is not yielding much conversation about real serious issues. So the things I talked about in the governor's race had to do with the cost of living in Massachusetts, the lack of any comprehensive policy around housing production, which is how we create jobs. And it won't change within the context of the two parties because they're so captured by these big moneyed interests and so focused on making sure that the policy differences are hidden behind vague platitudes. Mm-hmm. So it really is to restore that level of serious dialogue to our political process. We want to run candidates in 2016 that are going to be smart people, that want to be engaged with voters to build these kinds of relationships. The low voter turnout that we saw, for example, in the primaries of the Democratic and Republican parties, only 16% voted. A majority of the legislators this year ran unopposed. This is not a reflection of a well-functioning democratic process. That's what we're trying to bring back.
Well, you mentioned the idea of vague platitudes coming from the two main parties. Is that what you saw in the race between Martha Coakley and Charlie Baker?
I did. I mean, I was there for a lot of it, certainly in the debates that I was in. One of the big differences, for example, and one of the ones that I was in, I pushed on this issue of partners and the monopolistic consolidation of hospitals and how both Charlie and Martha had their fingerprints all over that. Mm. In the debates that I was not in, there was not any discussion of that, although we did find out about the Halloween costumes that people thought they should wear. About crying, they found out about credit card bills. I mean, really, the kind of stuff that you would, I suppose, be interested in if we were playing a get-to-know-you game, but not if we're talking about the real serious issues that families deal with across the state. Now, voters noticed this, and voters were puzzled enough seeing candidates being excluded from those debates, but more so seeing how it could be that our political discourse has fallen to that level.
Now, you spent about $1.4 million of your own money in this race. You've talked a lot about the need to fundamentally change the campaign finance system. How are you working toward that, or how can your party work toward that?
Yeah, well, it won't change until we elect people that will vote to make a change. You know, the as an independent, I was running under rules that said that I could raise one-tenth of the amount of money that the party candidates could. And that's skewed. And, of course, those are rules that were created by both parties. Super PACs, hugely influential in this race. They spent $20 million or so dollars dwarfing the amount of money that was spent by the candidate groups themselves. That could change, but it's going to require change to the law. And Democrats and Republicans are complicit in allowing for this to continue. So the work we're doing to build this new party, if we want to see publicly financed elections, if we want to see an end to super PACs, we better start to elect people that will make that happen because the existing establishment isn't going to do it.
Do you already have candidates lining up to join your party and to help raise money, raise issues, raise awareness?
We do. It's actually one of the remarkable things. Just over the last month or so, and definitely since the election day, we've had more than 20 reach out to us, say, I want to run. I want to be involved in this. If you go to our social media, if you went on the Evan Falchuk MA Facebook page and you saw all the people writing in, talking about how inspired they were, how much they want to be involved, that's what we were tapping into, what we saw all across the Commonwealth in the campaign. And that is exactly the stuff that we will be basing our efforts on over the next 2 years leading up to those 2016 elections.
Now, do I have this right that to remain a political party in Massachusetts, you'll need to get 43,000 voters to sign on? Is that right?
Yeah, it's another one of those arcane rules. So you have to get 3% of the vote in a statewide election in 2016, unless you've got a presidential candidate. There is no statewide election. So you keep your status by getting at least 1% of voters enrolled. That's one of the things we're really working hard on. We're actually waiting for the Secretary of State to issue the new forms so we can start enrolling people. We're pressing pretty hard to make sure that they get that done expeditiously.
I want to ask you this, just sort of the challenge of keeping this momentum going. The Green Rainbow Party also won official political status on Tuesday when three of its candidates won 4% of the vote. But the Green Rainbow Party has sort of gone up and down in official party status over the years. How do you prevent that from happening, from sort of maintaining this momentum that started?
I respect the Green Rainbow folks and certainly met with them. They're, keep in mind this, two things. One of them is that's a national organization. That's come here and has laid down roots. We built this from absolutely nothing more than ideas and people that were committed to doing it. So from a true grassroots perspective, that's what we've built. And that is what is continuing to happen. So you continue that by creating another level of that over the next couple of years. That's what we're doing. That's what it's about. And again, we aren't tied to an ideology that maybe a lot of people don't buy into. Mm-hmm. This is about how do we go about bringing back serious dialogue to our political process? Mm-hmm. How do we get away from ideological discussions and more towards what's real, what's meaningful? How do we connect? How do we build relationships? It's like anything else that you build. I mean, I've been a business person. You stay in business by serving your customers well. And unfortunately, in politics, it seems like that is not the case. We can do that. And that's what we're building.
You know, a moment ago, we were talking on the Week in Review about sort of the potential that Charlie Baker, Governor-elect Charlie Baker, has to work with a predominantly Democratic legislature. I mean, for government to work in Massachusetts, there has to be sort of, you know, people have to talk and work across the aisle. Do you see that as a potential to, I don't know, is there an upside to that that you feel positive about?
About which? The people working across the aisle?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you were just describing is what we call democracy.
Right.
And what has happened is that the parties have gotten in the way of democracy because we start to see everything in terms of which party is up and which party is down and not about how do we deal with the cost of living in Massachusetts? How do we deal with the corruption of campaign finance? How do we deal with both parties being involved in the monopolistic consolidation of hospitals. And it gets stuck in horse race coverage of the races and not about these issues. Now, it can change because most voters want to see that happen. What's been missing is that framework, which is what the United Independent Party is about. So that's what you'll see from me. I'm going to be doing this. I'm committed to this. I believe in this cause from the people that are working on it, from the organization we're building on the ground in so many different communities across the Commonwealth. This is how you bring about that kind of change.
I want to ask you just about one sort of interesting question and a little bit of a debate among political pundits about the effect you had on the governor's race. Charlie Baker beat Martha Coakley by 40,000 votes. You earned about 71,000 votes, and some political watchers suggested that that you essentially took votes away from Martha Coakley. Do you think you tipped the scales in favor of Charlie Baker? Do you think that's
No.
even okay? Good.
No, and the data doesn't show that. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting. I like that you used the word earned at the beginning because that is the way it should be. I mean, it's the responsibility of every candidate to go and earn those votes. They don't belong to anyone, and voters notice that. You know, anytime I heard this some version of this question almost every day for the last month or so of the election. But what was fascinating about it is that it was from both sides. Mm-hmm. They say, I really like what you're doing, but I'm worried that if I vote for you, it's going to make Martha Coakley governor. I'm worried about that if I vote for you, it's going to make Charlie Baker governor, but I really want you to be successful. And I tell them, just vote what you think is right. Vote for the person that you think is the best. So the data don't show that we tipped the scales. There were about 2 million people that didn't vote. You know, which should be the bigger concern that we have. We got to get people involved in our elections. And that's so much of what it is that I'm committed to in organizing and mobilizing people for positive change.
Literally, Evan Feljak, we've got like 10 seconds left, but I just want to ask you, what was the biggest lesson you drew from the election that you will apply going forward?
Hard work pays off.
Hard work pays off. Evan Feljak, he's the founder of the United Independent Party. Again, Evan Feljak, congratulations and thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So we had an election, and a lot of people might believe that when they vote for change, that's what they get. But that's not always the case, particularly when it comes to national security and foreign policy. So says Michael Glennon, who argues America is plagued by what he calls a system of double government. a government that we think we elected, and another one that actually carries out the policies. Glennon is a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts, and he worked for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee back in the 1970s. His new book is called National Security and Double Government. Among other things, it seeks to explain what he calls a troubling continuity of national security policy from the Bush administration to the Obama administration.
Drone strikes, whistleblower prosecutions, non-prosecution of torturers, NSA surveillance, CIA covert operations, claiming the state secrets privilege to block human rights litigation. Obama had, as a candidate, campaigned eloquently and forcefully against those sorts of policies, and yet they all seem to change very little in the Obama administration.
So the idea that these policies really didn't change dramatically when President Obama came into office is the result of this double government. So how does it sort of take shape? How is it constituted in the U.S.? Because I think we like to believe that when you elect a new president, things are going to change.
Well, it's the result of a set of incentives that are deeply embedded in the American political system. And you can go institution to institution, and you'll see what I mean. Members of Congress seek re-election above all else. The president and his staff and cabinet officers defer to the military and intelligence and law enforcement agencies. They share Madeleine Albright's famous question to Colin Powell, why do we have this splendid military if we're not going to use it? The military and the intelligence agencies, in turn, have an incentive to justify existing policies, as bureaucracies do everywhere. And the American people have an incentive to remain uninformed and passive because there's so little that they can do to affect these policies. So that's essentially the dynamic of double government.
Mm. You write in the book about a central delusion the American people are under, this idea that the president of the United States is the decider. You, however, call him the presider.
Yes. Well, this is probably the hardest thing for most Americans to understand, and it's completely counterintuitive because they've been inculcated with this notion and image of a presidency that's top-down. The president gives orders and everybody in the executive branch clicks his or her heels and salutes. That's not the way it is today. It's a bottom-up and middle-up institution with millions of employees, only 3,000 or 4,000 appointees directly responsible to and accountable to the president. And of those 3,000 or 4,000, only about 600 to 700 are in the realm of national security. So that's, for example, where the idea of the collection of telephony metadata by the National Security Administration didn't come from George Bush. It came from the bowels of the NSA bureaucracy. And in fact, it originated even before 9/11. These are the kinds of ideas that percolate up, and ultimately the president gets boxed in over and over, and there are exceptions, such as the killing of Osama bin Laden, where obviously President Obama played a direct role. But these exceptions sustain the illusion that the president is the decider, and in fact, he's really, as I say, the presider who defers to decisions that are made by others.
Well, let me ask you about something, because in thinking about your thesis and this idea, I got thinking about our recent history, and I was thinking about the lead up to the war in Iraq. And you know, maybe I'm suffering from this central delusion that you describe, but I had the impression that this was such a set of policies that was driven by George W. Bush, and that we might have had a very different outcome had someone else been in the White House.
You know, it's just impossible to figure out what the counterfactual would look like if Al Gore had been elected. There's no question that some policies would be different. But when you look, as you suggest, at policy after policy, the picture becomes clear. The NSA lied to Congress about surveillance, probably committing perjury in the process. The president did nothing. The CIA spied on the Senate intelligence committee that oversees it, probably committing multiple felonies in the process. The president told his staff on the subject of drone strikes that the CIA gets what it wants. He learned from the newspapers that Angela Merkel's cell phone was being tapped, and John Kerry, the Secretary of State, explained that NSA surveillance is on autopilot. That, to me, is what double government looks like. So there are exceptions, but by and large, they just continue to be the same.
You worked as a lawyer for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the 1970s, and I'm wondering, did you think about this then? Did you see evidence then when you were in Washington of this?
I did. I saw that, by and large, the same people from the State Department, the CIA, the Justice Department, the Defense Department were writing the same talking points and the same policy papers for Carter that wrote those things for Ford.
Are there any benefits to having a system of double government?
There are all kinds of benefits, and those benefits explain why it survives. The management of the law enforcement and intelligence and military departments and agencies are quick-footed. They are capable of operating with great secrecy. They're not subject to the policy oscillations of policymakers on the Hill. The problem is that these benefits tend to be short-term, and there are costs in accountability, and those tend to be long-term. So we tend to overvalue the benefits and undervalue the costs.
You express sadness in this book over your own thesis, and you write that you feel a great sense of loss at coming to this conclusion around this thesis. How so? Why?
Well, this great experiment of ours in democracy traces back to the belief of the framers that we could establish an equilibrium of power. That equilibrium only comes into existence when you have an informed and engaged citizenry, when you have an electorate characterized by what Madison referred to as civic virtue. Absent that all-important predicate, the whole equilibrium collapses. And that's exactly what we're seeing today. If the American people are interested in a solution, it's to look to themselves, not to the government. The government is the source of the problem. They can't expect hollowed out institutions, the Congress, the presidency, the courts, to exercise the very power that they lack. The power has to come from the outside. As Adlai Stevenson said, in a democracy, people get exactly the quality of government they deserve.
Boy, Michael Glennon, these are troubling but really important ideas that you've brought in here. Thank you very, very much for coming in.
Thank you, Anthony.
Michael Glennon is a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. His new book is called National Security and Double Government. There's a lot more information about it at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, the Boston Symphony smuggles some new music into its repertoire. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.